Foy Short, A Life in Southern Africa, Back to Africa. Foy and Margaret traveled back to Rhodesia with J.C. Reed and his wife Miriam. Foy had convinced Reed to go to Africa when he was at Abilene Christian College. The Reeds had an 18-month-old toddler, two twins that were 6 months old, and another baby on the way. Harold was 22 months old. Though air travel was still more expensive than an ocean voyage in 1947, the Reeds' supporting church offered to pay the difference so that the Shorts could fly with them and help with the babies. The Shorts left Decatur on a Greyhound bus for New York City, where they waited a few days in a hotel for their flight and for the Reeds. The two families were supposed to leave New York on the morning of July the 7th, but since there was a storm in the Atlantic, they weren't able to actually leave until later in the afternoon. The storm also required them to travel to the Azores Islands through Gander, Newfoundland, instead of going directly as originally planned. They ate most of their meals at the airports along the way, breakfast at Gander, afternoon tea in the Azores, and finally supper in Lisbon, Portugal. There, the two families had to wait 5 hours while the carburetor on one of the plane's engines was repaired. All through the flights and long waits at various airports, Foy, Margaret, and the Reeds had to feed and console 4 babies. Finally, the plane, a 4-engined Lockheed Constellation named Golden Fleece by Pan American, left Lisbon and stopped in Dakar, Senegal, before arriving in Accra, Ghana, about 3 p.m. on Wednesday. The plane was supposed to take off for Leopoldville, Congo, that's now Kinshasa, Zaire. But since there were no facilities for night landings in Leopoldville, the decision was made to wait in Accra at a BOAC rest house until the early morning of the 10th. BOAC stands for British Overseas Airways Corporation, and that's now British Airways. Margaret said, "Those of us with small children were given rooms with beds. The rest had to sleep on couches. We left about 3 a.m. and got to Leopoldville for breakfast." On the flight from Leopoldville to Johannesburg, South Africa, the pilot dropped down from his cruising altitude of 17,000 feet to 5,000 feet to circle Victoria Falls. Margaret described the airplane ride as rough. She said that most of the people on the plane, including Foy, were airsick when it descended for the passengers to view the falls. She and J.C. Reed were among the lucky few who were able to enjoy the view without nausea. When the families arrived in South Africa, they found out that they would be unable to get tickets on the weekly train to the Rhodesia for 3 weeks. They didn't have money to stay at the hotel for that length of time, so they contacted the American consul, who was able to pull strings to get them tickets for the train to Rhodesia in 1 week. Johannesburg was going through an unusually cold snap when the two American families were there. Margaret said, "Foy had told me that Africa was hot and I wouldn't need any heavy clothes. I had a coat that I didn't want to get rid of and fortunately had it with me. We had to go buy Harold a heavy coat. Miriam stayed with her children. J.C. Foy and I took Harold and did a lot of sightseeing." Finally, the Shorts and Reeds were able to load their luggage and babies on the train for their trip north into the Rhodesias. After traveling 500 miles, the travelers had a one-day layover in Bulawayo, where they were able to spend time with the brethren. Verna Hadfield told an amusing story about several young girls in the congregation at Columbrander Avenue in Bulawayo who had only recently been allowed to wear lipstick. When the group decided to go to the train station to greet the Shorts and Reeds, the girls were told that they should leave off the lipstick for the day so as not to offend what would certainly be old-fashioned missionaries. However, when Margaret stepped off the train, stylishly dressed and with makeup, Verna reported that the girls were delighted. After a brief visit with the brethren in Bulawayo, the Shorts boarded another train for their final destination of Namuyanga Mission near Kolomo in northern Rhodesia. They arrived there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day. Foy dutifully reported his travel expenses to the church in Ferris, Texas, including bus fare from Decatur to New York, $37.30, train fare from Johannesburg to Kolomo, $56.05, and hotel expenses in New York, $36.94, and Johannesburg, $53.50. The airfare for the family from New York to Johannesburg was $1,885.50. Of that amount, Foy and Margaret had to pay $898 apiece for themselves, while baby Harold traveled for a mere 10% of that, $89.50. Namuyanga Mission, Northern Rhodesia. George Scott and W.L. Brown started the Namuyanga Mission in 1932. It was about 4 miles from the town of Kolomo in northern Rhodesia. Foy's father built the chapel and several other buildings in the 1950s. In 1947, Alvin Hobby was the principal of the school at Namuyanga, but wanted to visit the States, so Foy agreed to take his place as principal for 6 months. Margaret had prepared herself to deal with primitive living conditions in Africa and was immediately put to the test. She, Foy, and the Reeds were assigned the oldest house in the complex that had been built by Scott and Brown. The Reeds lived in the front part of the house, and she and Foy lived in the back, which she described as a kind of lean-to. She said, "The living room had a screen and wasn't enclosed. That's why I kept on saying to Foy, 'How do I know a lion won't jump through?' She said, "The only door that locked was the one between the living area and two very small bedrooms, and a third even smaller one we used for bathing and dressing. Any time Foy was away overnight, Harold and I would go into that sleeping area before dark and lock the door. I had plenty of reading material and stories and nursery rhymes to read to Harold. I took in plenty of drinking water and anything else we might need for the night. The only time I remember feeling nervous was one night when we had a very severe thunderstorm and it looked and sounded like the lightning was striking all around us." Foy laughed at the idea of a lion, but several years after she and Foy left, some lions did get into the compound and killed some cattle. When thinking back on his wife's response to living conditions in Namuyanga, Foy said, "She was very brave about it." Shortly after their arrival in northern Rhodesia, Foy and Margaret went with some of the Americans to villages some distance from Namuyanga. The first day of the trip, Foy shot a dulker, a small antelope, and the whole group had dulker meat that night for supper. After observing her over a short period, several of the experienced workers told Margaret that she adjusted to African life more quickly than anyone else they knew. Margaret remembered being careful about snakes. "I would go out at night and take torches and look for snakes and make sure they weren't on the steps or in the toilet." She had been warned to do this, as some of the others had actually encountered snakes in the kitchens and outdoor toilets. During the 6 month stay at the mission, she had no snake scares. However, the week after she and Foy moved out and turned their apartment over to the Hobbies, they encountered a snake on the steps of the house. The champion snake killer among the American evangelists was Gladys Brittell, who was reported to have killed in her years at Sinde Mission some 65 snakes in the neighborhood of the woodpile and outdoor privy with a .22 rifle that had no sight. Bringing water into the house was not easy. Margaret said, quote, "We got there in the middle of July in the dry season. They had had a drought in the year before, so water was very scarce. All the other houses had big water tanks that collected rainwater. The house we had had one too, but it leaked since no one had used it for a long time, so we had no water for drinking. We had to go down to the river and get muddy water. What we used for drinking was boiled, and then we would let it sit a while. Close quote. Foy and Margaret enjoyed the company of their companions at Namwianga Mission. Besides the Reeds, they worked with the J.C. Shoemaker family, the A.B. Reese family, Myrtle Rowe, and Sybil Rickman. They often saw other American workers from other missions in northern Rhodesia, the Brittells from Sinde Mission and Boyd Reese and Eldred Eccles from Kabanga. Margaret worked in the mornings as a secretary for the school while a babysitter watched Harold. Then she took care of Harold in the afternoons. Occasionally, she and Foy would go into Kalomo. They didn't have a car, so they would put little Harold on the seat of their bicycle and walk along beside it down the road to the little town. Margaret said, "There were some stretches of road where the sand was not too deep for all three of us to ride, with me on the carrier behind Foy and Harold on the crossbar in front of him." She recalled that the primary businesses in town were a butcher shop and a department store that was managed by an Indian. Foy's responsibilities involved teaching and making sure that the other teachers and classes were in order. The first period at the school was always a Bible class, followed by more secular courses. Foy taught math and woodworking. He also made numerous forays into surrounding villages on his bicycle with Eldred Eccles to preach. He wrote D. H. Moyers of the Ferris, Texas Church that he, J. C. Reed, and Eldred Eccles had just returned from a trip to a village where white men had never preached before and baptized 22 people. He wrote his parents, who were visiting Texas, a more detailed account of his activities at Namwianga. Regarding an interesting class on evangelism with several young Tonga men, he said to his parents, quote, "In the class are Johnson Sigali, John Chongo, Pear, Aason, Ephraim, Paul Muita. You may know all, or at least some of these. They ask all kinds of questions and are very interested in what we are studying. They said the other day that every Christian in northern Rhodesia ought to be forced to take a course in personal evangelism. I just hope that they will remember some of the things we study together and will practice them themselves and will teach others what they themselves have learned." He mentioned a number of villages that he and Eccles visited. He said, "Eldred and I have traveled over 340 miles on our bicycle since the middle of August on preaching trips. So far, we have visited Sokis twice, Munakanyemba twice, Sindawe once, and Simapuka once, Kalefula twice, Mulamaba once, and Pukuma once." He gave a weather report. "It is now raining, the first rain since last season, and last season was near drought, so you can imagine how badly rain is needed here." Foy's childhood ability to speak the Chitanga language returned to him while at Namwianga. Margaret said, "I think he has a natural knack for learning other languages. I was amazed at how quickly he picked it up again since he was so young when he left." Foy laughed when recalling an incident that occurred shortly after he arrived at Namwianga. Some boys were talking among themselves in Chitanga, wondering when the superintendent of schools for northern Rhodesia would be coming back from his leave in England. Foy then spoke to them in Chitanga and told them when he was coming back. The boys were absolutely shocked that this new principal could understand and speak their dialect. They got the word out quickly that you couldn't make fun of teachers or talk about sensitive issues around Foy in their native tongue. Expeditions into the Zambezi River Valley. While Foy was at Namuyanga, he and Eldred Eccles made several long overland trips east into isolated areas of the Zambezi River escarpment, where no preaching had ever been done by any Western religious groups and where many inhabitants had never seen white men. These trips were like several that his father and other pioneers in Zambia took in the 1920s and 1930s. Foy pointed out that there were no roads into the area, not even for wagons, but simply footpaths. They had maps for some areas, but more often than not relied on the direction of the Africans to find villages where they could introduce the natives to Jesus Christ. Often, the Americans and their Tonga companions had to chop trees to clear the way. They occasionally only traveled about a mile a day in areas with thick vegetation, but in the savanna country they could cover 12 to 15 miles a day and occasionally even more. On Foy and Eccles' first trip, they took two Tonga boys and two oxen that dragged a sled made from two forks of a tree. They visited a number of villages where white men had never been seen, including one called Pukuma, or Pukuma's Village, where they would see some impressive spiritual success when returning several months later. On their first trip, however, the inhabitants of the village were so afraid of them that they fled when Foy and Eccles approached. Foy and his companion camped out close to the village to see if they could win the confidence of the villagers. A few eventually ventured forth to watch the two evangelists, and finally most of the inhabitants came out to observe them warily from a distance. They were too nervous, however, to receive teaching, so the two young men left and eventually returned to Namuyanga. In writing about this trip, Eldred Eccles wrote a page and a half about a misunderstanding between him and Foy about a missing water bag. He thought that Foy had drunk from it and berated him for it, only to find out that one of the Tonga boys had put it in a different place. He felt that the encounter caused their friendship to be never again as warm and unguarded as it had been. When asked about the confrontation 60 years later, Foy laughed and said, "I was amused at his summary of things. He felt much more disturbed about it than I was. It never bothered me. Maybe at that time it did, but I soon got over that." After moving to Bulawayo, Foy chided his best friend, Benny Lee Fudge, for not getting along as well with Eccles as Foy thought he should. He told Fudge, "You and he always managed to cross each other up." Then he said, "Eldred and I got along fine when we were together up north." Foy's letter to Fudge shows that any coolness in the friendship perceived by Eccles was not felt by Foy a year later in 1949. He always talked with great respect and fondness for his old friend, Eldred Eccles. Foy and Eccles' fact-finding trip to the east encouraged others from the missions to plan a return expedition to the area to try to teach the natives there. This second, more ambitious journey to the escarpment and down into the Zambezi River Valley made such an impression on the group that all who published works about their lives in southern Africa, Eccles, J.C. Shoemaker, and Alvin Hobby, wrote at length about it. J.C. Reed wrote an article in the Gospel Advocate about the trip that included Foy and Eldred Eccles' names as co-authors. The group decided that they would try to take a 2-ton Ford Model T truck powered by a charcoal gas producer that Orville Britell had modified. They loaded it with many of their supplies and an opaque projector powered by a carbide flame. With drawings, it could be used to present the gospel message. Thus equipped, the expedition set out into the area previously explored by Foy and Eldred Eccles. Eldred Eccles wrote more than 11 pages about the adventures of the second expedition through various villages, but the highlight of the trip was the breakthrough in Picuma, the village that he and Foy had visited several months earlier. When he, Foy, and their companions showed up in Picuma the second time, they were welcomed as friends. The initial fears of the villagers were replaced with openness. The evangelist tried to tell the elders about God in a dialect of the Chitanga language, using a Tonga brother named Mujuka as their primary interpreter. One of the elders said, "We also believe in a God who created the world, but we don't know how to worship him, or even if he wants us to worship him." The natives said that they sacrificed to their ancestors, hoping that they could intercede to this God on their behalf. The evangelist asked the villagers if they didn't think it reasonable that God would tell his people how to prepare themselves to meet him. One of them said, "It does seem reasonable, but we have no knowledge that it is so." The evangelist showed them a Bible and said, "This book is God's word to his people." The elder looked at the Bible a moment and then asked, "Did God himself hand you this?" The evangelist reasoned with the villagers about God and his book for several days in the face of some resistance, especially from the women of the village, who were led by an elderly woman named Benamuno. Finally, on the third day, after a gospel presentation under the starry skies, the chief elder, whose name was Pukuma, dramatically gave his reasons for believing that God had spoken through the book that Short and Eccles had brought them. When he finished, he said, "I stand." According to Eccles, a shocked tremor went through the groups. Then another man stood, then another, and another, until finally a large group were standing to profess their faith in Christ. When recalling the second excursion to Pacuma's village, Foy talked about material used to teach the illiterate natives with the opaque projector. He said, quote, "We had to have an interpreter to interpret the captions under each slide. Those people all had a strong belief in the great creator God who created all things. They believe that he created all things and rules in the affairs of men through the spirits of their departed ancestors. We never had to argue about the existence of a God, the creator of all things, until the advanced education of our civilization got over there with all the universities." Close quote. He also reminisced, "The old, old, old men told of their fathers having had a visit from David Livingston when he made his trip through there. None of them, however, had ever seen a white man." A few months later, Foy and Eccles returned a third time to Pacuma, but were disappointed to find many of the new Christians drunk when they arrived. However, Foy patiently remarked that many Corinthians were at first drunkards. When the villagers sobered up, Foy taught them that they must leave their drinking and be faithful to partake of the Lord's Supper each Sunday. They seemed to respond well to his message, and 14 more were baptized. They helped Eccles and him to find other villages in the area where they could preach. When searching old files in 2010, Ellen Bays found a 7-page typewritten report by her father about this third expedition into the Zambezi River Valley. In it, Foy mentioned that he and Eccles' primary goal was to visit a town called Mulola, where the gospel had never been preached. Natives from Pacuma and Siawassa told them that Mulola was 6 huts wide and 2 miles long. Foy wrote about the challenges he and Eccles had in trying to maneuver their oxen and supplies down into the Zambezi River Valley, following old trails that often disappeared into the vegetation that was increasingly thick in the lower elevations closer to the river. Though unable to reach Mulola in their allotted time, Foy rejoiced that 21 were baptized in all and that the new churches in Pikuma, Siawassa were strengthened. Googling Mulola, Zambia confirms that there is a place by that name on the Zambezi River, though Foy and his companion were unable to reach it. Eldred Eccles reported that when evangelists visited Pukuma years later, there was still a congregation there composed primarily of the women who had originally opposed the Bible message. Googling Pukuma turns up information that it is located at 3,605 feet in altitude above sea level, and that in 2004 it had a population of 1,363 and an airstrip. After moving to Bulawayo, Foy conceded that he might be unable to do this type of work in unexplored regions again. He said that it held a great appeal to him. He said, "The simple trustfulness of the primitive African when he realizes that you are trying to help him is very appealing." When initially frustrated with his work in Bulawayo, he even wrote his friend Benny Lee Fudge, "I wish I could forget the white work and concentrate on this type of work among tribal Africans altogether." Though he would do much village work in the future, most of it would be in towns and rural communities of Matabeleland around Bulawayo, where there had already been at least some exposure to Western culture. Foy did make at least two other trips into the previously unexplored areas of the Zambezi River Valley. One was with C.H. Bankston, Henry Ewing, and Alan Hadfield. On another, in about 1959, he went only as far as the Kalomo River with his brother Bill, his son Harold, Harrison Bankston, and Johnny Pretorius. On the latter trip, Harrison Bankston, who was about 15 years old, recalled coming to a gorge overlooking the Kalomo River and seeing two crocodiles on a sandbar on the river. Bill Short, the only one who had a rifle, shot one of the crocodiles, which immediately slipped wounded into the river. Foy and the boys found a way to clamber down the embankment to the river and lasso the wounded croc. While trying to drag it out of the water and up the steep side of the embankment, they accidentally knocked Bill's new rifle off of the rock where they had laid it, and with horror, they watched it fall into the river below. The next thing they knew, Harrison jumped into the river and successfully recovered the gun, even though he knew that the mate of the croc they killed and perhaps others were still there. Harrison recalled in October of 2010, "I didn't tell Dad and Mom about that." Radio program from Mozambique. While still at Namuyanga Mission, Foy and Eldred Eccles began to make arrangements to broadcast a shortwave radio program from Lourenço Marques in Mozambique, then called Portuguese East Africa, a program featuring Rural Lemons as the speaker. The Central Church in Cleburne, Texas, sponsored the program. Foy said that the program had a lot to do with getting the work going in South Africa. He said in his 6-page summary of his work, "Most of the responses from the correspondence course that was offered were from South Africa." There were a few congregations in South Africa in the late 1940s. The church in Johannesburg used instrumental music in worship, while the small church in Cape Town had split over its use. Foy and Margaret handled the encouraging amount of correspondence and feedback that came from the program during the first 2 years of its operation. He reported in August of 1948 that after a few months, he had received 48 requests for Bible material. Foy traveled by train to Durban in 1949 to baptize a contact from the program. Finally, after visiting the Shorts and others in Bulawayo, Several families from the States were able to move to South Africa in the early 1950s and follow up on contacts there. By the end of 1950, over 500 letters had been received in response to the broadcast, about 100 of them from the area around Johannesburg. The broadcast led to a constant flow of letters between Foy and Rill Lemons, discussing how much singing should be included in the programs. What besides the correspondence course to offer listeners who wrote in? For example, inexpensive New Testaments, tracts, copies of sermons, etc. Foy often sent typed excerpts of letters from listeners to Lemons. The two even discussed concerns over Lemons' accent, though Foy felt that most of the concern wasn't from Africans, but rather those out here from the USA. In the same letter, he recalled that when visiting Cleburne, Texas before leaving for Rhodesia, quote, "I heard you make some announcements at church services, and I certainly didn't notice any peculiarity in your accent," close quote. Lemons modestly and graciously offered to let someone else do the speaking on the program. Quote, "If my Texas accent distracts from the program, then I am just as anxious as anyone else to change speakers and get the most effective man possible," close quote. However, Foy thought that the Texas inflection wasn't that big of an issue and that people he talked to about the program were quite extravagant in their praise of the sermon material and construction. Foy and his friend Benny Lee Fudge also corresponded extensively about the radio program, since Fudge was constantly promoting contributions for it among churches in North Alabama. Some would promise to help, but then be late with their payments, which brought complaints from the church that was sponsoring it. In discussing the content of the broadcast, Foy told Fudge, quote, "We want to avoid anything that might give the impression that we are trying to import an American religion into this country. If the people ever get that idea, we are finished. The theme must strictly and emphatically be a plea for restoration of New Testament Christianity. We want to avoid giving the impression that we are another denomination trying to proselyte followers. Our theme must simply be back to the Bible. For that reason, we do not want to sign off with any such statement as, 'You have just been listening to a religious program sponsored by the Fairest Church of Christ.' We do not want to invite people to join our group. We want to invite them to come to the Bible and take their stand on it alone." Close quotes. Grappling with doctrinal problems. After Foy left Namwianga, his friend J.C. Reed, who stayed there, became very discouraged with several situations in Zambia, that is, northern Rhodesia. He wrote in 1949 about what he felt to be a de facto missionary society there, the General Meeting of the Churches of Christ Missions Registered. He then gave several specific objections to the organizations. Number one, he said, "It secures the permits for all workers coming into the country, thus controlling the entry of workers." Number two, "It owns all the church property in northern Rhodesia." Number three, "Through its placement of missionaries and native teachers, it in actual practice controls the churches." Number four, "It pays native teachers for preaching during vacation months. This should be done by the church." Number five, "It is such a mess that some of the missionaries make no effort to keep the schoolwork and the church work distinct." Number six, "The situation is further aggravated by the fact that women vote in the general meeting and have the power, by fact of being more numerous than men, to control the church through this means." He added, "This is the worst mess that I have ever been mixed up in." Interestingly enough, Foy defended the General Meeting of the Churches of Christ Missions against Reed's charges in a series of letters to Benny Lee Fudge. In essence, he said that the organization was necessary to get workers into the country and fulfill legal requirements in other areas. He asked Fudge, "Is the Athens Bible School a missionary society?" Fudge, however, wasn't convinced by Foy's argument, saying, "I'm still bothered about the organization set up in northern Rhodesia. It may be all right, but it sure looks like a step in the wrong direction to me." He then pointed out what he perceived to be weaknesses in Foy's reasoning. However, he said, "In spite of my misgivings, I'm not about to fly the coop and start a racket about the northern Rhodesia work. I know there's plenty I don't understand." As for Foy's comparison of the National Association in Northern Rhodesia with Athens Bible School, Fudge said, "I see absolutely no comparison. That organization, by its very name, Churches of Christ Missions, is doing the work of the church. Athens Bible School is not." The issue dominated correspondence between Foy and Fudge in the latter part of 1949 and came up time and again for several more years. Foy generally defended the Churches of Christ Missions organizations, while Fudge expressed strong doubts about it. Years later, when thinking of this exchange, Foy thought that though some of Reed's concerns were legitimate, others were probably overblown. Also, it should be pointed out that Fudge's concerns had nothing to do with what we sometimes call the sponsoring church plan, because he and Foy both thought that such an arrangement was acceptable in the early 1950s. Fudge was simply concerned that the title, General Meeting of the Churches of Christ Missions, indicated something akin to a missionary society. There were also concerns through the 1930s and 1940s that brethren in southern Africa were too soft in their opposition to premillennialism, the theory that Jesus will return to earth to reign 1,000 literal years. The premillennial publication, Word and Work, had promoted the work in southern Africa from the very beginning, and several early preachers there, S.D. Garrett in particular, promoted the concept. Though most preachers in the region in the latter 1940s did not believe the theory, J.C. Reed felt that many were too tolerant of it. He was particularly concerned about the arrival of Arthur T. Phillips, an avowed premillennialist, and the warm welcome he was given by most of his fellow workers at Namuyanga. By the time Phillips arrived in Namuyanga, Foy had already gone to Bulawayo, and therefore wasn't involved directly in the controversy about him, but expressed to Benny Lee Fudge that he felt his friend Reed had overreacted and used unwise tactics in trying to get his fellow evangelist in Namuyanga to take a harder line against Phillips. When J.C. Reed returned to the States in 1951 because of discouragement with Transit Namuyanga mission, he wrote an article in the Gospel Guardian documenting his concerns. On another front, Benny Lee Fudge wrote Foy about Alvin Hobby's visit to Nashville under B.D. Moorhead's wing. Hobby was the principal of Namuyanga School, whom Foy had temporarily replaced. Moorhead had been accused of sympathizing with premillennialists. Fudge said in his letter, "Brother Goodpaster was terribly wrought up over it, and I had to do some tall talking in Hobby's defense." However, Fudge felt that Hobby was learning that it would be difficult to work with premillennialists. He said, "Hobby sent an article to the Word and Work, appealing to the premillennialists to cease their teaching on the question, and Brother Bowles refused to publish it on the ground that to do so would be to agree to cease teaching the Bible. He gave Alvin quite a rebuke, which I think has helped him quite a lot." Foy wrote back to Fudge about conversations he had with his friend J.C. Shoemaker. He told Shoemaker that if a man believed the theory but kept it to himself and made no effort to teach it, I certainly would have no right to refuse to allow him to eat the Lord's Supper with us. However, If someone promoted the theory, Foy could not support, endorse, or encourage that person. Though the controversy about premillennialism waned in Southern Africa, it would soon be replaced in the 1960s by disagreements about institutionalism. Moving to Bulawayo. A few months after Foy and his family arrived at Namuyanga Mission, F. L. Hadfield from the English-speaking Colin Brander Avenue Congregation in Bulawayo, Southern Rhodesia, contacted him and several others about the possibility of moving there to work with the church. Hadfield, who helped start the congregation, was the most influential leader in the late 1940s. Though Hadfield and others in Bulawayo staunchly defended the right of the congregation to use instrumental music in their assemblies for worship, they did not go along with the modernist tendencies in the Christian church. In fact, they rejected a disciples preacher from South Africa because he denied the virgin birth. Margaret said, "They were much more conservative than that." Foy said, quote, "The congregation had worked out a compromise with the Bailey family from the old Path churches in England and Jimmy Clason, who was also opposed to an instrument. They did not use it in the Sunday morning breaking of bread service, and the others did not attend the evening services where they did use it." Close quote. Margaret recalled that when she, Foy, and several others traveled to Bulawayo to consider working with the congregation, they stayed in the guest house of the White Star Poultry Farm that was managed by Leonard Bailey, who was also the co-owner. The brethren finally asked Foy to work with them, agreeing to dispense with the organ completely for a six-month trial period. Foy's father had always been concerned about the lack of work done among the English-speaking population of Rhodesia and had encouraged Foy to consider dedicating himself primarily to that type of work when he returned from the States. The invitation of the Colin Brander congregation opened the doors for him to pursue that plan. Foy and Margaret made their plans to leave Namuyanga to move with Harold to Bulawayo in January of 1948, just after the Hobbies returned from the States. The only possessions that they had were their clothes, a second-hand sewing machine that had originally belonged to Margaret's mother, and a mimeograph machine. With youthful optimism, they set out for Bulawayo and a new life there. Foy estimated that Bulawayo had about 30,000 whites in 1948, mainly of British descent, who were living around the town center. There were larger numbers of mixed race and Natabele Africans in adjoining areas. Many English servicemen who had been stationed in the area during the Second World War fell in love with it and chose to make their homes there after the war. It was used as a training ground for RAF pilots, who were easy prey for German fighter aircraft when learning to fly over England. Housing was therefore in short supply and very expensive. While waiting to find their own housing, Foy, Margaret, and Harold moved in with the Jimmy Clason family, who had a large two-story house. Clason was the man after whom Foy and Margaret named their second son, Jim. And Gladys, his wife, was the daughter of F. L. Hadfield. The Shorts lived in one room and ate their meals with their host. Margaret and Gladys Clason shared the cost and also the planning of the meals. When Foy first arrived in Africa, he received $200 a month from his supporting church in Ferris, Texas. The brethren there thought that surely he would need more, but Foy felt that the $200 per month would suffice. However, after arriving in Bulawayo with its booming economy, Foy realized he would need more, and the congregation at Ferris upped his salary to $250 a month. According to Margaret, Foy was always reluctant to ask for more salary than that which would be necessary to live close to the poverty line. None of the young couples at Colinbrander Avenue were well off, but they wondered why the American Brethren didn't send the Shorts more. Foy told Margaret that many people sacrificed to send them, and that they should be willing to sacrifice too, and Margaret was willing to do just that. Margaret helped supplement the family income a little, enough for voice lessons, she said, by keeping books for a small furniture factory. Later, with Foy's help, she kept books for a slightly larger factory. She believed that their supporting congregation would have sent more if Foy had asked for it, but he was reluctant to do so. The congregation that met on Colinbrander Avenue with about 25 members had been influenced by English customs. For example, services were organized and conducted by one man called the presider, who called on others for participation. There were chain prayers, and the women covered their heads during prayer. At the end of the six-month trial period, the Shorts were invited to stay on permanently, with one of the older men telling them, "The young people prefer you to the instrument." The young people in the congregation were mainly children and grandchildren of the Christian families who had come from New Zealand. There were several young married couples. Most of the singles were in their late teens and early 20s. There were also some younger children from that area who attended Sunday school. 9 months after arriving in Bulawayo, Foy and Margaret were finally able to rent a house in the new suburb of Queens Park East. A note from Jimmy Clausen's doctor stating that he was a nervous kind of person and needed to have children out of his house helped cut through some of the paperwork. To provide more housing as cheaply and quickly as possible, their houses were built with what was called PISA construction. The walls were built of mud packed into frames and then painted. They were jokingly called mud huts. However, they served their purpose, and Foy and Margaret said the house looked pretty good to them. Their house was on the second row of houses to be built. They had to do without many conveniences, especially in the beginning. She said, "Our toilet was not usable at first, as the sewer trenches were still being dug. So there were small temporary buildings wired to pegs in the ground and with buckets that were picked up every day by the city's sanitation department." She added, "During that time, somebody sent us some used clothing. We used this clothing to buy several chairs, a dining table, and several small tables. Some of this furniture looked quite good, and we brought one of the larger chairs and some of the small tables back to the States with us for the children to keep. African men would take the articles of clothing and then go door to door to sell them. They preferred to have used clothing to money, as there was a big demand for the clothing in the townships, and they made more money selling them." She added, "We didn't have a refrigerator during the first years we were there. Unwrapped meat and bread were delivered by bicycle." The Shorts' primary mode of transportation after moving to Bulawayo, besides their 2 feet, was a 1925 motorcycle that Orville Britell improvised for them. Margaret said, "The pillion seat was quite high in the back. I would ride on the back, and Foy and Harold would ride on the tank. The road from the Clausen's house into town was a strip road. When cars met, they each moved over to the side, keeping one set of wheels on a strip of pavement. Motorcycles did not have to move off the strip of pavements onto the gravel, but bicycles did. Foy and Margaret's motorcycle only had a bicycle light, so at night they had to move off the strip as cars could not sense that the approaching vehicle was a motorcycle. All of the maneuvering on and off the paved strip on the motorcycle was quite frightening to Margaret." Margaret recalled how their transportation improved after moving to Queens Park. Quote, Soon after we moved to Queen's Park, Leonard Bailey gave us a baby Ford open tour with a canvas top, which I replaced at once with my Singer sewing machine. This little car gave us good service, and Foy used it for visiting churches in rural areas over very poor roads. In October of 1949, the pound was devalued, so the rate of exchange was then $2 to the pound instead of $4. This increased salary enabled us to make a down payment on a small English Austin pickup with a canopy, which made it possible to carry passengers in the back. By that time, a number of families had moved from Queen's Park as houses became available in more affluent suburbs. We began to drive to several areas to pick up Sunday school children who had moved, so we got the pickup for this just when we needed it. Brother Clausen did some of this with his large Chevrolet. Later on, others also helped. Close quote. The devaluation also allowed the Shorts to manage a down payment on a small refrigerator. Margaret said, quote, "October is very hot there. It's called the suicide month. So what a welcome addition that was. It was supposed to be delivered one Saturday morning, but they weren't able to do so until Monday. I had so anticipated it that I felt I could hardly get along without one for another 2 days, even though it had been 2 years and 3 months since I'd had one." Close quote. Teaching children in Queen's Park. Soon after Foy and Margaret moved into their new two-bedroom home in Queen's Park in September of 1948, while he was still preaching at Colin Brander Avenue, he and Margaret decided to start teaching neighborhood children and teens in their home on Sundays. The Colin Brander Avenue congregation agreed that this would be a worthwhile project. Several members from that congregation brought the few children that had been studying there to the children's Bible study at Queen's Park and also helped with the teaching. Foy felt that he was greatly helped in his teaching of the children by the fact that there was no competition from other churches of any kind in the immediate area. Of this work he said, quote, "When we started having Sunday school in our house, I went around to every house in that suburb inviting people, and again I was commended. The people said, 'Our church isn't doing anything out here, and we want our children to go to Sunday school.' So it was really a golden opportunity that dropped in our lap." Close quote. Margaret recalled, quote, "We had classes in the kitchen, living room, and both bedrooms, and finally our next-door neighbor offered us the use of one room. For seating in the classes, Foy assembled picnic-type tables held together with large bolts so they could be assembled when needed and then taken down and stacked against the back wall of the house. There were no sidewalks, and even the side streets were not paved at first, so when it rained, a lot of red mud was tracked into the house. Fortunately, they were cement floors, and we had a yard worker who came in and washed them. I will be forever grateful to Auntie Gladys Clausen for giving us lunch every Sunday through all the years we were having services there. We could just take the tables down, go to lunch, and have clean floors when we came back." Close quote. Ellen Bays found a circular letter in an old file that her father wrote after 5 sessions of the Sunday school to distribute to homes in Queen's Park. The letter, dated March 10, 1949, advised parents that 17 children attended the first Sunday school sessions, 25 the second, 48 the third, 45 the fourth, and 56 the fifth Sunday. Eventually, the Shorts enrolled 120 children in their Sunday Bible classes. Foy advised the parents that there were 4 classes for children from preschool through 14 years of age and reassured them that the teachers were experienced and furnished with good material. As to which denomination sponsored the Sunday school, Foy wrote, "We, the teachers, are doing our best to be strictly undenominational. We plan and try to teach nothing but the undenominational Bible story of God and his dealings with mankind and of Jesus and his loving work of redemption. One of the homes Foy visited was that of 9-year-old Paddy Kendallball. Kendallball was born in South Africa, and his family moved to Bulawayo in 1947 by way of northern Rhodesia, now Zambia. His parents worked in various stores and towns and mining areas in southern Africa. Kendallball said, "One day, a man with thinning hair knocked on the door. 'My name's Foy Short, and we're starting Bible classes for children here in Queen's Park on Sundays.'" Paddy's father, though not a religious man, encouraged his four oldest children to attend the Bible classes in the Shorts' home. Rona Klassen taught Kendallball his first Bible class. He became a Christian at 14 years of age, and after a brief falling away as a teenager to pursue sports, he became a protege of Foy's, studying intensively with him as a young man and eventually dedicating himself to preaching the gospel. Beginning work among the Amandebele. When Foy arrived in Bulawayo, there were only about four congregations composed of African brethren around Bulawayo that had been taught by men from the Christian Church from New Zealand. He said, "Soon after we got there, I conducted a 3-week Bible study course for the African preachers who came in from the countryside. They knew nothing about Bible authority, what it was, how to establish it, how to follow it. That was the main thing I stress." Foy wrote in August of 1949, "Today is the second day of a 10-day special training course for native leaders of the church in this area. We have 10 men in the class. We have 4 1-hour courses each day in each of the following: the New Testament Church, denominational doctrines, problems of the African evangelist, preparation of sermons. These fellows are as keen as mustard. They keep the questions coming as fast as I can answer them. It is a joy to teach such enthusiastic seekers after truth." Newman Gumbo is a respected evangelist who has been preaching for many years in Zimbabwe. His mother was a Christian that lived in the Rangemoor area, just out of Bulawayo. Gumbo told Ellen Bays that their early teachers from the Christian church set up a system where if you were a man, you were required to give 1 shilling each week. If you were a woman, you were to give 6 pence. And children were to give a tikkie, that is 3 pennies. If you did not have the money, it was written down and an account kept of how much you owed God. Foy, of course, taught them that their giving must be as they prospered and from the heart. Gumbo recalled that his mother and the others were very happy when they realized that God did not make this rule. They no longer had this burden of owing God money, but could give freely. Foy found that the Nabele preachers wanted to learn about differences between the biblical pattern and the teaching of different religious denominations that were in their villages. After his helplessness in facing Mormon missionaries as a young man on the ship to Africa, Foy sympathized completely with their plight and dedicated large portions of his teaching sessions to contrasting the Bible approach to serving God with that of popular religious denominations. Foy described a typical study session with his Nabele brethren. "Normally, there were tons of questions. If there was a lull in the questions, I would start discussing a particular denomination and the doctrines that characterize that denomination." Foy felt that emphasizing the difference between the work and worship of Bible churches as opposed to that of popular religious denominations was one of the keys to the steady growth of churches in Matabeleland. Foy's teaching efforts among the Amandebele involved 2 approaches. First, going into their villages and teaching the churches one-on-one. And two, occasionally during the off-season, when the brethren weren't plowing or working extensively in the fields, inviting them for a 2 or 3 week session of extensive Bible studies in Bulawayo. Shortly after Foy began his sessions with the African teachers, one of them said, "Now we can go out and fight the enemies of the gospel. Now we have the weapons to fight them with what the Bible says." During the late 1940s and early 1950s, several times a month, Foy made trips of between 2 and 4 days into the country, sleeping on the ground outside of the villages. Sometimes the whole family went with him. Foy said that during that time, it was completely safe to do so, something that would unfortunately change in later years. Margaret remembered a long trip to a congregation near the Botswana border in the early 1950s. She said, "The flies were so bad, I had to keep everything covered up. We made beds on the ground." Foy reported to the brethren in Ferris, Texas, about a trip to a community about 110 miles west of Bulawayo. The first night of the meeting, he issued a challenge in reply to a charge by opposing preachers in the area that the African brethren were preaching something which no white man would embrace. Foy wrote, and I quote, "That charge had a profound effect on the natives. They have a boundless confidence in the intelligence and wisdom of the white man, and so they embrace that if no white man would embrace the teaching, then surely it must be because there was no truth in it. Of course, my appearance on the scene as a white member was a partial answer to the charge. Then I offered a reward of £5 to any person who would show us the scripture that named the London Missionary Society, the leading denomination in the area, or the Catholics or the Methodist. The next day, that neck of the wood fairly hummed. I met one man in the village the next day who said that he had searched his New Testament and found that my words were true. Native members told me that discussions and arguments had raged in every village and at every gathering in the area the next day. The result was that the second night we had over 500 present for service. The London Missionary Society preacher dismissed his service and brought his entire flock to attend our services. At that service, I repeated my offer and mentioned the fact that so far there had been no claimants for the reward. I also emphasized the fact that we must go by the Bible alone in religious matters." Close quote. After services the second night of the meeting, 21 people requested baptism. Though they had difficulty at first finding enough water in the dry season, Foy found a farmer 4 miles away with a small pond who reluctantly granted permission to use it for baptisms. The final number of those baptized was 40. Foy describes some of the unique features of those large evening evangelistic meetings in the villages of the Amandebele in 1950. Quote, "The singing at these night services is a curious affair to newcomers to this country. Barring an occasional flickering little kerosene storm lantern, there is usually no kind of lighting system apart from the smoky wood fire. Consequently, the majority of the audience is in darkness. And even if sufficient lights were available, so few have songbooks that 90% of the audience would be unable to sing from books. To overcome these difficulties, the song leader cuts off quickly at the end of each line and shouts out as fast as he can the words of the following line, then immediately begins singing with the congregation. This takes a great deal of breath and quick thinking, but some of them are so proficient at it that scarcely a beat is lost throughout the entire song. Of course, unless you are an expert linguist, it is rarely possible to distinguish the words shouted out by the song leader. He says them so fast." Close quote. The initial successes among the Amandebele in the late 1940s and early 1950s would be precursors of ever-increasing spiritual opportunities in Matabili land. End of this section of chapter 3.